8. The Lighter Side of Life at the Supreme Court. Opera is hardly the only basis for Justice Ginsburg's friendships with her colleagues on the bench. The following speech, given by Justice Ginsburg frequently over the years, discusses the lighter side of life at the court and highlights customs that have helped encourage collegiality, something Justice Ginsburg values highly and promotes constantly among the justices. Lighter Side of Life at the United States Supreme Court. Remarks presented to the Association of Business Trial Lawyers, U.S. Grand Hotel, San Diego, California, February 8, 2013.
Well, in these remarks, I am going to talk not about the heavy lifting we do at the court, but on the lighter side of life in our marble palace, and speak about some customs that promote collegiality among the nine of us. My first comment concerns our routine gatherings. They begin with handshakes. Before the start of each day in court and before each conference discussion, as we enter the robing room or the adjacent conference room, we shake hands, each justice with every other. And for the mathematically inclined, you would have figured out that that makes 36 handshakes. Every day we hear argument, and every day we meet to discuss cases, we lunch together in the justices' dining room. The room is elegant in dimension and decor, but the lunch is hardly haute cuisine. It comes from the court's public cafeteria, the same fare available to anyone who visits the court. We lunch together by choice, not by rule, usually 6 to 8 of us, sometimes all 9. When Justice O'Connor is in town, she left the court, sadly for all of us, in 2006. When she's in D.C., she often shares the lunch hour with us and enlivens our conversation with reports of her travels and her efforts to promote judicial independence in the United States and around the globe, also of her iCivics project to advance education about the U.S. Constitution and government in our nation's grade schools. Justice Stevens, who retired in 2010, also joins us occasionally. He is now 92, still an avid player of tennis and golf. Justice Souter retired in 2009. He is not fond of city life, except Boston. So we seldom see him in D.C., but he sits regularly on First Circuit panels. What do we talk about at lunch? Well, perhaps the lawyer's performance in the case we just heard, or a new production in town at the D.C. Shakespeare Theater, or the Washington National Opera, or the latest exhibition at the Library of Congress or the National Gallery. And sometimes our Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Alito speak of their children, the older members, Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Breyer, and me. We speak of our grandchildren. From time to time, we invite a guest to vary the lunch table conversation. Invitees in recent years include our former Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, the former president of the Supreme Court of Israel, Aharon Barak, retired justice of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, Albie Sachs. So far, retired Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and former president of the World Bank, Jim Wolfensohn, have been our only repeat lunch companions. That is so because both have an unusual talent. They can engage in lively conversation and consume their lunch at the same time. We also celebrate justices' birthdays with a pre-lunch toast, a glass of white wine, and a happy birthday chorus, generally led by Justice Scalia. Because if truth be told, he is the only one of us who can carry a tune. It is traditional also, when a new justice comes on board, for the former junior justice to arrange a welcoming dinner all of us attend. Most recently, Justice Sotomayor hosted a dinner honoring Justice Elena Kagan with entertainment provided by members of the Young Artists Program of the Washington National Opera. Another example of events we host every now and then, mainly for lawyers and judges, we take turns greeting attendees at dinners for newly appointed federal judges gathered in D.C. for a week of orientation. So just this week, Wednesday evening, I greeted a large assemblance of baby judges, many of them from California. We also take turns introducing speakers at the Supreme Court Historical Society biannual lecture series. I am active in the Historical Society, and I'll mention just a couple of programs in which I participated. A few years ago, the program was on the work and days of Belva Lockwood. If you don't know that name, you will after this lunch. She was the first woman ever to gain admission to the Supreme Court's bar. In 1876, the justices denied Lockwood's application for admission. The vote was 6-3. The reason, she was a woman. She did not go off in a corner to cry. Instead, she lobbied Congress relentlessly for 3 years, and in 1879, Congress passed a law requiring the Supreme Court and all federal courts to admit women who possess the necessary qualifications. Not content simply to practice law, Belva Lockwood ran twice for the U.S. presidency in 1884 and 1888. Now, that was long before women had the right to vote. But Belva Lockwood said, "I can't vote, but nothing in the Constitution says I can't run for office." And so she did. Some months later, I presided at the reenactment of arguments before the court in a famous case decided in 1908, Mueller against Oregon. The case involved an Oregon law that limited the hours women could be gainfully employed to 10 per day. The defendant was prosecuted for violating the law. He was a laundry owner, a man who wanted women employed at his laundry to work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. The debate involved in that case persisted for decades. The question was, are protective labor laws applicable to women only permissible, or does the equal protection principle of the Constitution require that labor laws protect male and female workers alike? An annual pleasant pause each May, just after the court's hearings are over, our last calendar is at the end of April, and before the intense end of May, early June weeks, when we must produce all the opinions for the term, just before that hectic period, we hold a musicale. That tradition was inaugurated in 1988 by Justice Blackmun, who passed the baton to Justice O'Connor when he retired. And for the last 12 years, I have attended to arrangements for the musicales. A few years ago, it became so popular, we added a fall recital as well. I'll give you a sample of our recent performers. Metropolitan Opera stars Renee Fleming, Susan Graham, Joyce DiDonato, Stephanie Blythe, Thomas Hampson, and Bryn Terfel. At our musicale last spring, the principal artist was world-celebrated pianist Leon Fleischer. Another special event every other year, the women in the Senate and the women at the court meet for dinner. The first such dinner was held in 1994. There were two of us, Justice O'Connor. And there were six senators. In 2012, there were three of us and 17 women senators. Not enough, but certainly heading in the right direction. During weeks that the court is not in session, some of us spend a day or two visiting U.S. universities or law schools or attending meetings with judges and lawyers, as I am doing at this very moment. Midwinter and summer, some of us travel abroad to teach or to learn what we can about legal systems in other places. One recent example, in February 2012, I visited Egypt and Tunisia to mark the first anniversary of the Arab Spring. In September 2013, we will have an exchange in Ottawa with our counterparts on the Supreme Court of Canada. And in February 2014, we will travel to Luxembourg for meetings with members of the European Court of Justice. Work at the Supreme Court is ever-challenging, enormously time-consuming, but tremendously satisfying. We are constantly reading, thinking, and trying to write so that at least lawyers and other judges will understand our rulings. As you may have noticed, we have sharp differences on certain issues. Recent examples include federally mandated health insurance, affirmative action, public school desegregation plans, the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, control of corporate spending to elect or defeat candidates for public office, access to court by detainees at Guantanamo Bay, state efforts to apprehend undocumented aliens. But through it all, we remain collegial, and most of the time, we genuinely enjoy each other's company. Ordinarily, our mutual respect is only momentarily touched by our sometimes strong disagreements on what the law is. All of us appreciate that the institution we serve is far more important than the particular individuals who compose the court's bench at any given time. And our job, in my view, is the best work a jurist anywhere could have. This is true of all federal judges. Our charge is to pursue justice as best we can. The Founding Fathers were wise enough to equip us to do that by according us life tenure and salaries Congress cannot withhold or diminish. My former boss, Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist, spoke of the role of a judge using a metaphor from his favorite sport. The Constitution, he says, has placed the judiciary in a position similar to that of a referee in a basketball game who is obliged to call a foul against a member of the home team at a critical moment in the game. He will be soundly booed, but he is nonetheless obliged to call it as he saw it, and not as the home crowd wants him to call it. The day a judge shirks from that obligation, Chief Justice Rehnquist counseled, is the day he or she should resign from office. I concur in that counsel.